Today is April the 21st, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, that's a Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Adobe co-founder and inventor of PDFs, Charles Geck, dies at age 81. Charles Chuck Geck, a co-founder of the leading software company Adobe, who invented PDFs, passed away last Friday at age 81. As co-founders of Adobe, Chuck and John Warnock developed groundbreaking software that has revolutionized how people create and communicate in some of the most transformative software inventions, including the ubiquitous PDF, Acrobat, Illustrator, Premiere Pro, and Photoshop. Geck met Warnock while working at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. The two left the company in 1982 and founded Adobe to develop software. Their first product was Adobe PostScript that provided a radical way to print text and images on paper and sparked the desktop publishing revolution. Geck retired as president of Adobe in 2000 after nearly two decades of managing the company. President Barack Obama awarded Geck and Warnock the National Medal of Technology in 2008. In addition to his lasting impression on the tech industry, Geck also famously survived a kidnapping attempt in 1992. Two men seized him at gunpoint as he was arriving at work one morning and held him hostage for 4 days, demanding ransom. The Associated Press reported at the time he was eventually rescued by agents with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Google's alternative to third-party cookies, Federated Learning of Cohorts, or the acronym is FLOC, pronounced FLOC. A couple of weeks ago, Google announced it was beginning to test a new ad technology inside Google Chrome called Federated Learning of Cohorts, or FLOC, and it uses an algorithm to look at your browser history and place you in a group of people with similar browsing history so that advertisers can target you. It's more private than cookies, but it's also complicated and has some potential privacy implications of its own if it's not implemented properly. Google Chrome is built on an open source project, and so FLOC was implemented as part of that project that other browsers could include. FLOC has received some stinging criticism, mostly based on how it would share a summary of recent browser history with marketers, something third-party cookies could try to do, but were never guaranteed to be able to do so. Its core design involves sharing new information with advertisers. However, nobody else is implementing FLOC right away because the way FLOC is constructed. No browser vendor except Chrome is joining the FLOC. Brave has this statement that the worst aspect of FLOC is that it materially harms user privacy under the guise of being privacy-friendly. Vivaldi, which is another browser, says we will not support the FLOC API and plan to disable it, no matter how it is implemented. It does not protect privacy, and it certainly is not beneficial to users to unwittingly give away their privacy for the financial gain of Google. Microsoft's Edge position is it's a no with some important context. Firefox says they won't buy into the assumption that the industry needs billions of data points about people that are collected and shared without their understanding to serve relevant advertising. Opera, they say they have no current plans to enable features like this in the Opera browser in their current form. DuckDuckGo isn't thought of as a browser, but it does make browsers for iOS and Android. On desktop, it's already made a browser extension for other browser extensions to block it. Apple Safari, Well, their statement is the industry is on a journey, and when it comes to balancing new advertising technologies and privacy, that's not a yes or no. They're on the fence. The backlash against Google's federated learning of cohorts, Flock, has continued with a proposal raised in the WordPress core to block the controversial alternative identifier to third-party cookies by default. The WordPress proposal to use its weight to thwart Flock is that they have approximately 41% of the web. For users that want to enable Flock, the proposal states those users would likely be able to do so themselves, and a little more code would allow Flock to be able to be toggled on and off. A significant number of WordPress sites only update to minor versions. By backporting, they can protect more sites and more visitors to those sites. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is very much against Flock, has made even a website to let you know that if you're one of the few Chrome users who have been included in the Google's early test without your knowledge, you can visit the Electronic Frontier Foundation to determine if you have been affected. You might visit a website that relates to highly personal subjects that may or may not use Flock ads. And now every other site that you visit gets told your Flock ID, which shows that you have visited that specific kind of site. The Electronic Frontiers Foundation said the era of third-party cookies was over, and the decision was now whether to allow users to decide what information to share or a behavioral label attached to users that is rich and meaning to those in the know. All of this is happening because every major browser already has or will soon block third-party cookies, the default way of identifying you and tracking you across the web, and every major browser has committed to ensuring that you can't be personally identifiable to third-party advertisers. The future of the web is at stake. Nobody really knows what advertisers will do once those tracking methods are eliminated, and so right now, major browser vendors are proposing different new solutions. Many browsers are already blocking third-party cookies. Google Chrome is the big holdout on blocking third-party cookies, but it is also the browser with the biggest market share. New York State bill to provide affordable internet to low-income families. I have been receiving queries of my reaction about New York State legislation on the bill to provide affordable internet to low-income families. Everyone was citing what they have read or heard from the various news media services. For me, I opted to try to download the bill to find out what was actually passed. The mainstream media coverage has been grossly over the top and did not match the statement released by the Office of the Governor. The exact wording of the bill signed by the New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, programmed to provide affordable internet to low-income families, has not been posted on the New York State website, but his office has released a statement which provided the following information. This legislation requires providers operating in New York State to offer $15 a month high-speed internet to low-income families across the state. Internet service providers are limited as to who are franchised to provide such services. There are areas in which there are multiple companies franchised in specific geographic locations. Then who has the responsibility for providing the service when there are multiple ISPs? The governor's statement does not specify by name any internet service providers. The legislation defines low-income families. New Yorkers qualifying for this affordable internet program include households who are eligible or receiving free or reduced price lunch, supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits, Medicaid benefits, the senior citizen or disability rent increase exemptions, or an affordability benefit from a utility. This new affordable internet program will impact 7 million New Yorkers and 2.7 million households. Well, that was a statement from the governor's office. Just taking the facts as presented, we have the following demographics. According to the United States Census Bureau, there are 7,056,860 households in the state of New York. That means that 38% of households in New York State are low-income families, of which the average size of a low-income family in New York State is 2.6 people. The published statement from the governor's office included the following. The governor's comprehensive 2021 connectivity agenda builds on his work, leading to the nation in delivering equitable internet access for all New Yorkers. In 2015, the state, under Andrew Cuomo, undertook the largest and most ambitious broadband initiative in the nation, dedicating $500 million, or that's $500 million, to broaden internet access statewide. This investment, coupled with regulatory reforms, expanded the reach of broadband so today 98% of New York households have access to high-speed broadband with download speeds of at least 100 megabits per second. This statement seems to be in conflict with a statement in the same published statement that 38% of households cannot afford the internet. Well, what is not in the statement from the governor's office as reported by the mainstream media is that there is no statement on internet for low-income people needing a 100 megabits per second download would cost $20. There is no mention of equipment for the service being free. There is no mention of free installation of the equipment. There is no mention, as reported by one media, that a router is required for the internet service. You do need a modem, though. And there is no mention if this applies to locations that have no internet coverage. The $15 a month high-speed internet to low-income families was embedded in the passage of the annual fiscal budget. There were no hearings. This measure was passed first, so we can find out later what was in the bill. This is a new norm for legislation. Are business websites subject to the American with Disability Act? A federal appeals court ruling that a Florida grocery store, Winn-Dixie's website, did not violate the American with Disability Act. The ruling contradicts a 2019 decision by a different appeals court holding that Domino's, which is a pizza restaurant in California, did violate the ADA when it failed to make its app accessible to blind people. The disagreement between courts creates uncertainty about the rules that will govern online accessibility in the future. Winn-Dixie is a grocery store chain with locations across the American South. The claimant is a blind Florida man who patronized Winn-Dixie stores in the Miami area for about 15 years. A few years ago, he learned that the store offered customers the ability to fill prescriptions online. Ordering online saves customers time because prescriptions are ready when the customer arrives. The claimant also preferred to order prescriptions online because it offered greater privacy. In court, he testified that ordering in person as a blind man made him uncomfortable because he did not know who else was nearby listening as he told the pharmacist his order. Unfortunately, the Winn-Dixie website was incompatible with his screen reading software that the claimant used to surf the web, rendering it effectively useless to him. Incensed and irate, he stopped patronizing Winn-Dixie and filed a lawsuit under the Americans with Disability Act. He argued that the inaccessible design of the Winn-Dixie website discriminated against blind customers like him because it forced them to order prescriptions in person, a process that is slower and offers less privacy. In his lawsuit, the claimant also said he couldn't access two other features of the Winn-Dixie website, a store locator function and the ability to clip digital coupons and automatically apply them at the register with his loyalty card. In 2017, a trial court made a ruling in the claimant's favor, finding that Winn-Dixie's website discriminated against blind users. Specifically, Title III of the ADA requires that a public accommodation such as the grocery store must provide disabled customers such as the claimant equal access to its goods and services, facilities, privileges, advantages, or accommodations. Winn-Dixie had argued that the law defines public accommodations to only include physical locations like a store. A website isn't a physical location, and hence it's outside the scope of the law, the grocery chain had argued. But the lower court disagreed. They said that where a website is heavily integrated with physical store locations and operates as a gateway to the physical store locations, courts have found that the website is a service of public accommodation and is covered by the ADA. A website might not be a physical location, the lower court reasoned, but a customer who can't use the website doesn't have full access to the store's services, privileges, and advantages, such as the service of ordering a prescription ahead of time for quick and discreet pickup. The grocery chain appealed the case to the 11th Circuit Appeals Court, which then reversed the ruling 2-1. The two-judge majority placed a lot of weight on the fact that the ADA only applies to physical spaces. In their view, a website is not a public accommodation as the ADA defines the concept. And while filling a prescription in person might not be as private or convenient as placing an order online, the judges argued that it was good enough to satisfy the ADA. Although claimant was not always happy with the speed or privacy of the services he received at the pharmacy, nothing prevented him from refilling his prescription during his time as a Winn-Dixie customer, wrote the judge for the majority. But a dissenting judge argued that the online prescription feature was a service of the physical store and therefore subject to the ADA. The majority opinion warned that such a broad interpretation of services would open up a Pandora's box. The dissent concluded, visually disabled individuals cannot access the website's content. They are not receiving a comparable or like experience to that of sighted customers. But the majority opinion of the other two judges said, under such an expansive interpretation, virtually anything from the tangible to the intangible might be deemed a service, privilege, or advantage. They argued that Congress didn't intend such a sweeping interpretation of the law. The ruling runs directly contrary to a 2019 decision by the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court, which covers California with several other western states. In 2019, the Ninth Circuit ruled that Domino's had violated the ADA by failing to make its online ordering system accessible to blind customers, and the Ninth Circuit agreed. Domino's website and app facilitates access to goods and services of a place of public accommodation. The Ninth Circuit held that Domino's website and app facilitates access to goods and services of a place of public accommodation. They are two of the primary and heavily advertised means of ordering Domino's products to be picked up at or delivered from Domino's restaurants. Hence, while the website itself might not be a place of public accommodation, an inaccessible website impedes blind customers' access to the Domino's restaurant, which clearly is such a place. This situation, where two different appeals courts take divergent positions on the same legal question, is known as a circuit split. For now, businesses in the western states will be required to follow the Ninth Circuit broad interpretation of the ADA and make their websites accessible. Meanwhile, businesses in the three 11th Circuit states, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, won't have to worry as much about making their websites ADA compliant. Businesses in the other circuits will have to wait for their own appeals courts to rule on this question if they haven't done so already. Of course, some businesses might decide to make their websites accessible just to be on the safe side, especially if they do business nationwide, but others might decide to wait and see how courts rule on the issue. This week's ruling was made by a panel of three 11th Circuit judges. The claimant could still request that the case be reheard by a larger group of judges. The claimant could also appeal the case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reviews only a fraction of the rulings made by lower courts. However, the High Court uses circuit splits as an important signal of which cases are worth taking. So the fact that the Ninth and 11th Circuit disagree makes it somewhat more likely that the High Court will intervene. And you know who the winners will be in this case? The lawyers. Developing new technologies in digital photography. Digital photography is under constant technological changes. It has greatly changed the way we process an image. The smartphone has become the de facto device for the masses to record videos and photographs. Most smartphones use a stacked system of lens to change the size of an image. This adds both weight and bulk. But that could all change in the near future with new lens technology. Cameras with optical zooming or equivalent means sharper photos, reducing the space and weight this takes up on your handset. Of course, optical zoom is available today with a separate camera. The difference is that for most people, the smartphone is carried every day, which enables you to have it handily available to record that moment in time. When you want to zoom in while using your smartphone camera, you have to pinch the screen. The phone software crops the frame and enlarges it. This results in a degraded image and can result in blurry photos. This is not optical zoom. At Scope Photonics in Ontario, Canada, they want to create lossless zoom for all kinds of images, which means any photo enjoying a close-up will remain consistently sharp. The team has been working on a type of technology harnessing liquid crystals, made popular by liquid crystal display, that's LCD screens, found in living rooms and retail displays across the world. Scope Photonics has found a way to make liquid crystals spin like tops and reorganize themselves based on how light moves through them. The light is to mimic an optical zoom lens system. So instead of a series of lens, Scope system can zoom in and out with just one lens. Scope is prototyping the lens technology on medical devices first and aims to bring these lens to smartphone cameras in 3 years. They are predicting they can achieve up to 10 times zoom with liquid crystals. There's another company emerging from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is the upstart Metal Lens, that's M-E-T-A-L-E-N-Z, and they want to get rid of that camera bump found on the back of your smartphone to brighten and sharpen images at the same time. They use plastic and glass lens elements stacked over an image sensor, but Metal Lens design harnesses a single lens built on a glass wafer between just 1 and 3 square millimeters in size, which is hugely very tiny. Its silicon nanostructure manipulates light rays in a way that allows for brighter and sharper images compared to standard lens elements. Metal Lens is also working on fine-tuning the focus applications on cameras, including for video imaging. They want to improve real-time autofocus so the camera is picking out the right object to put into focus. Another sector Metal Lens is eyeing is virtual reality and augmented reality, which requires headsets and goggles made up of image sensors and lens. In virtual reality especially, those companies want to reduce the bulkiness of those headsets. In Utah, there's a group of researchers who have developed a lens 100 times lighter and 1,000 times thinner than the iPhone 11's lenses. Rajesh Menon, associate professor in electrical and computer engineering at Utah University, says a common problem for current phone cameras is spotting out-of-focus reds and blues and correcting that often requires an additional lens. The lens he helped create comprises thousands of microstructures instead of one large curve element. All these programmed microstructures focus light on an image sensor in the same way as thicker traditional lens. Thinness is a requirement feature with smartphones for consumer acceptance. When you can reduce the size of all the lens you normally have in a camera, which are all designed to correct for color aberrations, one single lens can simplify the process. Reducing the weight of imaging devices, even if it's just a fraction of a gram, could be a big deal for delicate technologies such as satellites and drones. This technology is being tested on imaging projects led by the U.S. Department of Defense. Lens innovation is moving at a quick pace, but firms also have to remember that smartphone users are accustomed to simplicity. Working on creating the equivalent of optical zoom is Adobe. They are approaching it from a software perspective. You can use a camera with a larger sensor, but then there is added weight and cost. Now there is another option. Adobe has developed just a thing called Super Resolution. Adobe's new feature now shipping in its camera RAW 13.2 and coming soon to Lightroom and Lightroom Classic applies artificial intelligence and machine learning to your photographs, analyzing and comparing millions of images to create older and crop pictures in the shop photos at bigger sizes. Adobe has shipped the first version of Photoshop that can run natively on Macs equipped with Apple Silicon and also has announced a new feature for Adobe Camera Raw that's ACR, called Super Resolution that is available today. Super Resolution is a new feature to Adobe's Camera Raw that uses machine learning technology to boost the resolution of an image, resulting in higher quality results than ever before. Adobe reported to be able to turn a 10-megapixel photo into a 40-megapixel photo. Imagine upsizing an old photo taken with a low-res camera for a large print. Super Resolution builds on a technology Adobe launched 2 years ago called Enhanced Details, which uses machine learning to interpolate raw files with a high degree of fidelity, which resulted in images with crisp details and fewer artifacts. Adobe reasoned that similar machine learning methods might enable them to improve photo quality in other ways. The term super resolution refers to the process of improving the quality of a photo by boosting its apparent resolution. Enlarging a photo often produces blurry details, but super resolution has an ace up its sleeve. An advanced machine learning model trained on millions of photos. Backed by this vast training set, super resolution can intelligently enlarge photos while maintaining clean edges and preserving important details. Super resolution doubles the linear resolution of an image, resulting in 4 times the pixel count to the new digital negative, that's DNG, when applied. The feature is currently limited to final DNGs of 500 megapixels, which is really a big file, but not enough for folks at Adobe that promise they're working on increasing the limits. Your computer will put on its thinking cap, crunch a lot of numbers, then produce a new raw file in the digital negative format that contains the enhanced photo. Any adjustments you made to the source photo will automatically be carried over to the enhanced DNG. You can enhance DNG just like any other photo, applying your favorite adjustments or presets. The feature works not just on RAWs, but also on other formats like JPEGs, PNGs, and TIFFs. Super resolution doubles the linear resolution of a photo, which means that the resulting image will have twice the width and twice the height of the original, or 4 times the pixel count. Images are currently limited to 65,000 pixels on the long side, 500 megapixels. If you try and apply super resolution to a photo that would exceed these numbers like a big panorama, you'll end up getting an error. However, the Apple team are working on ways to raise the limits in the future, but for now they think 500 megapixels is a plenty big start. Adobe is now looking into ways to extend super resolution to produce even larger and cleaner results. With all this rapid pace of technological innovations to achieve optical zoom capabilities, we'll soon be able to capture that Kodak moment with a smartphone. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his continuing IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to the Office Part 2.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time we get down to business. And this is where we talk about, yes, your interaction with technology in the workplace, but I wanted to get kind of into a direction which is loosely based on the technology of business, but more about the business, because we are going to be going through a lot of different things along this road back to normal. This is a 6-part series. Last week we talked about the business side decisions that are going to be made. Now, we're going through this post-COVID outlook on work by covering staying home and you want to, going back and you want to, go back and you don't want to, stay home and you don't want to, and then the hybrid model. But anyways, let's dive in. The first one. Okay, so look, I only touched on the surface of this last week with the business side, but most people are interested in the personal side. So let's talk about this. The first option, staying home and you want to. Look, I get this. You are used to this and you adapted. We as a world adapted to this. I'm going to bring back a comment that I covered last week. I opened up talking about the fact that we went from 9% of the people working from home to 95% of the people working from home. Okay. You're getting the best of everything here on this option. You're staying home and you want to. You're going to be fine for the most part. Most of the people who are going to be covered later on, they're going to be the ones who are going to struggle a little bit more. Okay. I admit many companies are welcoming the idea of less in spending money that they have to give out, less capital that they're going to have to expend on office space. And this is a great option if you're, you know, working with family around and stuff like that. It's good. But I want you to remember there is a downside. And A, that is, or first off, rather, you have to maintain productivity. You're going to have to continue being productive. Now, I also want you to get out and go to events with your coworkers. Look, I understand if you're staying home and you want to, it could be because you are an introvert. All right. The last thing we want to do is take an introvert and then shove them into this little corner and keep them in that corner. Last thing you want to do as an introvert is being shoved into that corner and staying in that corner. I know you enjoy it there, but I want you to grow. I will tell you that I have my introvert side and I have my extrovert side. There are times where, yes, I would love to be the wallflower, and there are times where I want to be the life of the party. It's weird. I'm a radio guy. I should always be the life of the party, but no, that's not the case. So let's talk about this. I want you to get out and engage face to face. There is a bond that is formed over the water cooler. We meet very cool people. We meet interesting people, and I want you to grow. I want you to be better than you were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, as far as your introversion. And let's face it, staying at home and you want to, you're leaning towards that. But, you know, there could be other things. You may be really into this whole social distancing thing. That's okay. But as we all get vaccinated, I still want you to break through that barrier. So, yes, meet people face to face, keep up that bond, but also communicate via voice. I want you to make friends along the way. I want you to use voice communications wherever, whenever possible. I want you to increase efficiency by using voice instead of emails or chat messages and stuff like that. I mean, I do want you to leverage technology all the way through this, but I want you to be personable on the other side. So what do I want? I want a goal out of you. I want to set this goal for you. Yes, we should embrace the technology, but get a goal of 3 voice phone calls where you're actually in a communication. I'm not talking, you know, voicemail. Oh, I tried to call 3 people. Yeah, you knew all 3 of them were out of the office. That's cheating. No, I want 3 voice phone calls a day, where you're interacting with someone, where you're growing, and you spend a little bit of time chit-chatting about the weather or hobbies or something else other than work. It's water cooler. It's a new type of water cooler, but at least try a little bit. Do you have to force it on someone? No. I also want you to keep in touch with your boss regularly. That's going to be very key. Last but not least, let's focus back into technology. Make sure that your current computer is up to date. Make sure your technology is up to date. Make sure that your work at home office isn't something that's on the kitchen table. This is something where if you are working from home, I want you to have a legitimate office chair, a legitimate office desk. I want you to have a legitimate office workspace. If you're going to spend the next 2 years, 3 years, 4 years at this company or any other company working from home, you need to make it a business environment. That's what I've done. I have my computers all aligned. I have what I refer to as my office, my computer room. And yes, I have everything set up so that I can work efficiently and being just on top of things without distractions. And that's what we all need. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The global shortage in semiconductor chips. Consumers are facing consumer price rises and shortages of products as a global shortage in semiconductors grows. The shortage in chips and electronic devices in the world has been steadily worsening since last year. Initially, the problem was only a temporary delay in supplies as factories shut down when the coronavirus pandemic first hit. Car manufacturers investing in tech-heavy electric vehicles, the boom in sales of TVs and home computers, and launch of new game consoles and 5G-enabled mobile phones have all driven demand. Apple was forced to delay the launch of the much-hyped iPhone 12 by 2 months last year due to the shortage. Ford recently canceled shifts at two car plants and said profits could be hit due to chip shortages. Nissan is idling output at plants in Mexico and the United States. And Sony, which along with other console makers have struggled with semiconductor shortages. Microsoft's Xbox has said it has supply issues. Samsung, the world's second largest buyer of chips for its products, after Apple said it might have to postpone the launch of its high-end smartphone due to the shortage, despite also being the world's second largest producer of chips. Samsung sells $56 billion worth of semiconductors to others, and they themselves consume $36 billion worth of chips themselves. Find that it may have to delay the launch of one of its own products. Samsung highlighted a significant issue, saying that there is a serious imbalance in the pecking order of who is getting the limited supply of chips. Car manufacturers who cut chip orders as vehicle sales fell last year found themselves at the back of the queue when they tried to reorder when the market rebounded. The entire global car industry buys about $37 billion worth of chips, with Toyota and Volkswagen spending more than $4 billion each. Although production is back to normal, a new surge in demand driven by changing habits fueled by the pandemic means that it is now reaching crisis point. How and why the great chip shortage happened? The global chip shortage came as sudden news to many investors in industries that relied on semiconductor chips. Playing a pivotal role has been a series of external forces, including trade restrictions, offshoring, and the global COVID-19 pandemic. There is a perfect storm of supply and demand factors going on here, but basically there is a new level of demand that can't be kept up with. With the vast majority of chip production for U.S. and global technology original equipment manufacturers now being done in Asia by the likes of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, Samsung, and United Microelectronics, we are currently experiencing the potential downside in which there is minimal onshore production capabilities. There was no more significant catalyst than COVID-19 coupled with a wildly inaccurate forecast tied to the unknowns of a sustained global pandemic. When COVID-19 hit China, it caused the first wave of supply constraints. Factories shut down to deal with the pandemic, producing a slowdown in manufacturing that led to a drop in items that would require chips. As the pandemic moved from China to across the world, the issue went from one of limited sales capacity for chip-dependent industries to one of potentially halted demand. This is where the deepest shortages originated. In the early days of the global pandemic, we saw unprecedented demand for PCs, cameras, keyboards, and displays. People who had PCs realized they needed better versions and multi-person households could no longer share devices. This growing demand led to over 10% growth in the PC market for 2020, and surging demand in the fourth quarter reached 25.4%. In itself, that caused a chip crunch, as demand didn't just peak for a short period to help people work and learn remotely, but the need stayed high with expectation that it would continue for at least a few more quarters. COVID-19 didn't only drive demand for PCs, it fundamentally changed our behavior. It halted going out to eat, attending a ball game, or going to the movies. This behavioral shift moved dollars from venues to home entertainment. people in droves were buying smart TVs, streaming services, and game consoles. Like PCs, all of these are dependent on volumes of chips, and this demand wasn't expected and therefore wasn't forecasted. Tablets had their strongest demand since 2015, with over 160 million units sold in 2020. For Chromebooks, over 11 million units were sold versus less than 4 million a year earlier. Smart TVs flew out the door, up from less than 4 million units in the fourth quarter of 2019 to nearly 5 million units a year later. Coupled with this were complete errors in economic forecasts. The first was the mobile smartphone industry. With the rising demand for PCs early on in the pandemic came a narrative of stifled demand for smartphones. When all of us locked down at home, we were supposed to see material increases in mobile devices demand. While forecasters were right in the early onset of the pandemic, it was business as usual for the smartphone business industry by the third quarter. By the fourth quarter, demand had surged to nearly pre-pandemic levels, down by only 2%. The 5G cycle, including the introduction of Apple's 5G variants, further spurred demand. The supply constraints for smartphone chips were evident in recent earnings results such as Qualcomm's, which said sales were restrained by lack of semiconductor supply. This theme was echoed among chip makers, including Intel, AMD, Nvidia, and Micron Technology. The second big forecasting miss came in the automotive industry. Shutdown due to COVID-19 in factories, coupled with the expected economic strains, led automakers to cut forecasts for production and vehicle demand. And while the estimates for decreased automotive sales looked to be around 15% year-over-year for 2020, much like the smartphone market, the demand for new vehicles has surged into the close of 2020, leaving many automakers, including GM, Ford, and Honda, short on the chips required to produce cars. For 2021, forecasts are expecting growth of demand for new vehicles to jump around 10%. This wave of demand further stresses the semiconductor industry, as a new vehicle can have upwards of 50 chips, with hybrid models often requiring two times the number of semiconductors as traditional vehicles. In both cases, the smartphone makers and automotive manufacturers heeded warnings of massive downtrends in demand, so they cut their semiconductor forecasts. Since access to chips is entirely dependent on manufacturing facilities that handle the global demand for chips, those cuts led to big holes in supply. Some may not understand that as soon as smartphone or automakers cut its orders, the foundries move on to the next order, filling demand for the next in line, putting the original manufacturer at the back of the line in what is perceived as an on-demand world. This industry has a queue, which means those who cut orders are left waiting. Only some companies stockpiled. Some companies were more proactive than others. Recently, Toyota said capacity would be unscathed by the semiconductor shortage. The company identified the opportunity to stockpile excess chips during the original pullback, which it will use to handle current increases in volume. Huawei, among a global regulatory battle, most notably with the United States, has taken a multi-year proactive approach to stockpiling the essential chips it was dependent on the United States. While we increasingly hear about Huawei's challenges, including the massive opportunity to disrupt the 200 million-plus mobile devices sold by the company annually, the situation could have been even worse had it not been holding on to key components. On a temporary basis, almost every business dependent on semiconductors is being adversely affected by the shortage. Excellent results for smartphone and PC makers could not have been better if supply were available. The increase in demand for vehicles is also a positive sign of the recovery and stimulus at work, but lacking unit availability is likely to limit results for the next few quarters, and in some cases could impact jobs, which would come at a difficult moment in the global economic environment. Based on the expectation that demand should settle to a more normalized level, much of the industry seemed to feel the most impactful period of the shortage could subside by mid-year. The most likely course of stabilization will be a focus on onshore manufacturing of a greater chip-making capacity. Taiwan Semi is already expanding in Arizona, but it will require more significant resources to prevent further supply issues. The good news is that over the past two decades, government investment in semiconductor manufacturing have been fruitful in yielding strong economic growth that comes from the ecosystem of semiconductors, in including materials, manufacturing, distribution, R&D, and more. In terms of the national security implications, this issue has been somewhat conflated with the current shortages. Still, this situation also deserves attention in bringing manufacturing back to the United States that would vastly improve security interests. With Samsung's proximity to North Korea and Taiwan Semi sitting right on top of China, there would be greater stability in having increased physical security via domestic manufacturing. A perfect storm of global macro-environmental circumstances has led us to this substantial shortage in semiconductors, plaguing industries and leaving consumers in the lurch while also driving up prices for certain components. The situation will largely subside with normalized demand, but given the industry's expectation of 8.4% growth in 2021, there are still challenges ahead. With cloud, mobile, software, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and remote work just a few of the forces that won't be slowed down in the coming years. The demand for chips, materials, software, OEMs and peripherals will all but certainly continue to grow. That means opportunities for strong earnings and revenue performance, but only if we can build the infrastructure to keep up with it. Presenting Marty Winston with All Hands on Tech, the ins and outs of air quality.
Take a deep breath. Did you taste anything? Did you smell anything? You should have. Both. Except that whatever it is you're not sensing is almost certainly something that snuck up on you so slowly that your nostrils and your taste buds take it for granted. Can you smell cologne? Onions? Dirty clothes? Disinfectant spray? Fabric softener? Cooking? Nature may have created onions, but the oil you fry them in, that's yours. Many of those aromas reach you as aerosols, tiny droplets in the air. Then there are also tiny particles in the air, dust, ash, pepper. And how about humidity? Is it damp? Is it dry? All these things are factors in indoor air quality. Do you care? Should you? Keep listening. Outdoors, what's in the air? If you have pollen allergies, you might be able to recite each one of them and the levels they're hitting today. They're seasonal, of course. If you're around pine trees, pine pollen can stain everything you keep outdoors, from patio furniture to convertible tops. If you're unlucky, and a surprising number of us are and just don't know it, you're also breathing radon gas. But there's more to outdoor air quality or indoor air quality than just pollen. There's dust, there's pollution, from automobile exhausts to factory chimneys to microsoot to concrete and asphalt particles that driving kicks up from the roadways. There are fireplace smoke, grilling smoke, and people who puff on tobacco smoke. There's evaporation from ponds and standing water. There are fumes from paint and adhesives, sawdust from wood cutting, sprays for fertilizing or weeding or insect control, all that's stuff. Be aware, not alarmed, and while you're at it, know your options. Start with your furnace filter. When's the last time you changed that? Any other air filters in the house? Any of them due or overdue for a change? Once the pollen bombing run ends, grab a blower, a brush, a hose, a power washer, whatever you have, and get it all cleared off your window screens. Odds are the windows may need a wash, too. Humidity, well, that's something you can control. If you have an indoor hygrometer or anything that tells you the relative humidity, try to find a second to read it at least once a day. Shoot for a reading of 50% relative humidity. Overall, between 40 and 60 is good. Over 60, too humid. Fabrics and wallpaper and furniture and doors and frames may start complaining. Your family may feel sweaty. And you won't feel tip-top. under 40 is too dry. Many of the same things, and people can suffer, just in a different way. When it gets too dry, start with drinking extra water. Then think about this old trick. While you could buy a humidifier, there are other ways to add moisture to the air. Got a spare fan? Blow it into a pan of water and check the numbers again in an hour. Hang a big waterlogged bath towel over the back of a chair and it will wick water into the air. Or worst case, when you wash your clothes, hey, hang them on a clothesline that's strung across your room. Of course, when you do that, you'll never convince people that you're not single. Those masks you got for coronavirus protection may also stop aerosol droplets or particulates from getting into your body. If you have enough fans and extension cords, you can set up, well, like it's like a moat of blown air that will keep a lot of stuff away from the house. But they're only good when there's not much wind. And when there's not much wind, there's less reason to use them. It's a balancing act. Watering the yard will help keep the top layer of soil from desiccating into loose dust. A broom and a blower on your walks, drives, and steps will leave less dust there to blow. And check your doors and windows for weather stripping gaps. The HVAC system here has a humidifier, a dehumidifier, and a fresh air intake blower, all under the intelligent control of an advanced Honeywell thermostat. They all help, but it's unreasonable to expect perfect results. Filtering air purifiers can help, too. The most advanced IAQ monitors, IAQ's indoor air quality, the most advanced of those monitors keep track of things that are hard for many people to fathom. Several of them, for example, can give you data on VOCs, meaning volatile organic compounds, which most people know and recognize under a simpler and more familiar one-syllable name, fumes. If you can smell fumes, those are usually VOCs. There are carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and ozone and nitrogen dioxide. There's almost always some issue to address when one of those reads too high, but don't obsess. Then again, things like ozone and many hydroxyls, formaldehyde, and gaseous hydrogen peroxide can irritate your breathing passages and make you more susceptible, not less, more susceptible to a respiratory infection. Still, don't panic. Indoor and outdoor air quality are all about breathing. Breathing. You've done that before, and you'll do it again. Probably. Which is just another way of saying, be sensitive to those changes. If breathing bothers your eyes and they start to feel dry or tear up, figure out why and do something. If you go on a snoring binge, figure out why and do something. If your throat gets dry or sore, if your nose feels soggy or crusty, if you find yourself breathing more through your mouth and less through your nose, yeah, figure out why and do something. Work out the puzzle and solve it. Next time, it's all about work, about getting back to the office, about multiplexing instead of multitasking to get more done with the same work, about the 40-plus pounds that millennials have gained while working from home, and how the office is going to be different. Be here for our report on stewed salaries, or if you're an hourly worker, call it When the Clock Punches Back.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Software for Landing Perseverance on Mars, Thursday, April the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, May 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. And the Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. That's limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.